Welcome to Living Your Life by Design, a conversation of self, health, and wealth with the sole purpose of advancing and enhancing the lives of women. And now, your host, certified career consultant, life coach, and author, Kathy Holloway Hill.
Hello, everyone. You have Kathy Holloway Hill here with you for the next hour, and I do believe my co-host is on the line as well.
Hello, Hi. Hi there. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. Been a little bit under the weather, but other than that, I'm doing all right.
Yeah, I knew that. That's why I asked how you were doing, because I knew you were kind of going through some things with your throat and strep throat. I'm not sure exactly what it turned out to be, but I knew you were kind of struggling with that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I didn't think I was going to make it to the show, but the doctor just released me, so I was able to make it. So good to be here.
Excellent. I'm so happy that you're here with us, Tony. That's great. I know you're not in the chat room yet, but they're saying hello to you in the chat room.
Well, great. Thank you very much to everybody. And I know you've been dealing with some things this week yourself.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. For those of you that are listening for the first time, you may or may not know that here on the Living by Design show, we always like to start our shows by giving a positive comment or a word of encouragement or a thanks or a shout out.
Yeah.
And tonight, I really want to send my prayers out to all the victims in Texas and all the other states that were affected by Hurricane Ike. Wow, this was a devastating storm. I don't think that the meteorologists or the people that predict storms, I don't think that they actually knew that it was going to hit as many states as it did, because I'm here in southern Indiana, right across the bridge from Kentucky, and Kentucky and Indiana, southern Indiana, has been hit in a very, very devastating way. We have over 500,000 people in the state of Kentucky without power. The water supply has been affected. The water company actually doesn't have power, so that's why the water supply is affected. So it has been very devastating. My prayers go out to the people that lost loved ones, because there were quite a few deaths as a result of the storm. I'm not sure exactly how many, but I think they said at least 40 people were killed as a result of the storm in Texas. And there are still millions of people in Galveston, Texas, that are without power. And, wow. How is it in Indianapolis, Tony? Did you all get hit with anything?
Well, yeah, I know there are actually still some neighborhoods and some areas here in Indianapolis that are still without power after this past weekend. And they're estimating that those in their pockets, primarily in the west central and some in the southmost part of town, were hit and still without power. Power lines went down when trees were blown over, because we had remnants of Ike and winds from anywhere from sustained winds 40 to 50 miles an hour to some gusts up to 70. So some trees in some neighborhoods and light poles and power lines were blown down. So we're not as widespread as have been in your area, and definitely in the northern part. I know Illinois and actually in the South Bend area in Indiana are still in the same situation that there are places in Kentucky the same way in southern Indiana. So not as bad, but it's still a lot of folks, a lot of stoplights still out, a lot of folks don't have water and things like that.
Well,
I want to give a shout out
to people that really helped me out, because I have been without power pretty much all week. It just came back recently, and there have been so many people that have opened their doors, opened their homes, and offered to help me out in so many ways, and I really want to thank all of my family and friends, including you, Tony. Tony offered to, you know, let me stay with him while my power was out, and I really do appreciate that. It means so much when you're going, because I've never been through a devastating storm or aftermath of a situation like this, so this is a first for me. And it can be, you know, very overwhelming. So it means a lot when your friends and family step forward and you know, try to put themselves out there to help you out. And I really do appreciate that. So thank you to you, Tony, as well as all the other friends and family members that are listening.
You're welcome.
And I also wanted to just talk a little bit about a few of the upcoming topics before we bring our guest on the line, because we have a great topic this evening. I think you're really going to enjoy it, because we all have to experience public speaking or communications of some sort at one point or another in our lives. Before we get to that, I just want to talk about next week's topic is going to discuss the very important issue of single parenting. And I know that can be a very challenging situation, trying to raise preteens, teenagers, and just, you know, raising children alone is, you know, difficult. So, you know, even when there are two parents in the house, so when you have to do it alone, it can be pretty challenging. So we're going to talk about that next week, and we're going to have Dr. Joanne Cutler with us to talk about that. The following week, we're going to have Ms. Barbara Corcoran, and she has had an amazing life story, and I can't wait to bring Barbara on. She's a self-made millionaire, and before that, she held over 20 different jobs in her life, and she was a waitress, and at the time that she decided to change her life, she's going to come on and tell us about that, and she's an amazing lady. She's a regular contributor on the NBC Today Show, and she's been on CNBC's The Big Idea. She's a best-selling author, and she's just an amazing lady and a great friend, so I can't wait to bring her on. Now, tonight's topic, overcoming the fear of public speaking. Now, Tony, you are in the industry where I know you do a lot of public speaking, and what we are actually doing right now, hosting a radio show and presenting, I know people think this might be somewhat easy, but it can be very intimidating and a little scary at times. You know, wouldn't you agree?
Well, absolutely, particularly that first time that you do it, the first few times that you do it, it's always the unpredictables. Doesn't matter really how much you prepare for any situation or scenario, there's always going to be something that you didn't prepare for. And I think that's the kind of thing that really gets you ready for any situation. You have to go through it to get to it. And yeah, so you do get nervous. You get nervous. I still get nervous, and I've been doing it for 28 years, so
sure.
So yeah, it still happens at times. Not as often, but it just depends on, like when I was speaking in front of the president, the couple times that I've done that in front of Clinton and Bush, got a little nervous.
Well, now, Tony, come on now. I know you're just trying to be modest, because I was at the event when you spoke for President Bush. I wasn't at the Clinton event, but I was at the one when you spoke for Bush, and you were flawless.
I was still nervous.
You were flawless. You were absolutely flawless. You may have been nervous, but it absolutely did not show at all. You are just absolutely a professional, and I just, you know, I admire you so much. And so that's all I'm going to do that, because I don't want to just, you know, go on and on and on about my co-host. But I do think you're the greatest co-host in the world.
Well, I appreciate that. I think the same thing about you.
Aw, thank you. So, but I want to talk a little bit about Dr. Lori Nadell. She is on the phone waiting to join us, and Dr. Nadell has had a wonderful career. She is educated in both psychology and journalism, and that's a very interesting combination. So I can't wait to bring her on the line. I know she started out in journalism, and she now deals mostly with psychology issues. And she was a columnist for the New York Times and also a writer and producer for both CBS and ABC News. And she's been on many talk shows, including Oprah. And, you know, I know she's been featured in the Associated Press, Investors, Business Daily, Ladies Home Journal, and many other publications. So with that, I am going to bring Dr. Lori Nadell on the line. Hello, Dr. Lori, are you there?
Yes, I am, and it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for accepting my invitation. I'm very excited about this topic that we're going to be discussing this evening, because you and I spoke last week and we had a great conversation about this, and it's something that, as I'm sure you was listening in, as I stated to Tony, that, you know, even what we're doing right now, hosting a radio show, and there are so many different opportunities where we have to really put on our best foot. You know, we have to put our best effort and put our best foot forward in these scenarios. And sometimes it can be very intimidating and not quite as easy.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yes. And, in fact, it's said that the fear of public speaking is the number one fear in the United States. It's greater even than the fear of death. And I always say that's easy because when you're dead, you don't have to face an audience, not that we know of, so you don't have to speak in public. So it wouldn't be as scary. Somebody who, like myself, I had a 30-year phobia of public speaking. And, in fact, I had a very successful career as a writer and a producer who worked behind the scenes. And I didn't even know that I had a fear of facing an audience until the first edition of my book Sixth Sense came out. And a friend said in a well-meaning way, "Oh, I can't wait to see you on television." And I burst into tears and I left the room. And I just went into the state of panic and I thought, there's no way that I can never go on TV. And then I realized that I had this phobia and that it had actually been running my life because I created an entire career that was based on being behind the scenes. And I did it so well, I was so successful. The phobia was so successful that I didn't even know it was there until it was time to go out and promote my book.
Now, Dr. Lori, why is public speaking the number one fear over death? I mean, that's amazing to me. Why is that? What is the fear? I mean, what are people afraid of?
Well, firstly, I mean, I think this is research that and I haven't checked the latest list, but I know it was true a few years ago that I think particularly in the United States, people are very conscious and very concerned of how we appear. Not wanting to make mistakes in front of other people, fear of embarrassment, fear that other people will ridicule us. Maybe we've had experiences as children, and I'm sure most people have had the experience of having to stand up in class and, read something or do an exercise in front of the class, and you make a mistake and everybody, laughs, or the teacher makes a sarcastic remark. So there's usually some, fear of shaming that is part of it, and not feeling in control, the feeling that, people are going to be watching you and looking to see what kind of mistakes you're going to make. And so there's your picture of the universe then is if I step outside my comfort zone and I go out and I face a group, that group is going to start off with a predisposition either not to like me or to judge me, and that's what you're picturing in your mind, and that's what you're telling yourself, and so your body is feeling the fear of that.
And I don't mean to make light of it, but what that reminds me of, and I'm sure everyone has seen that famous scene in Carrie, that movie that was so popular back in the 70s, Carrie, when her mother said, "They're all going to laugh at you."
Right.
Remember that scene? They're all going to laugh at you. And she kept hearing that over and over in her head. And, you saw what it did to her. I mean,
right. Well, there were all messages from parents, of course, and teachers, and, also other kids, siblings. But, parents in particular, parents very often project their own fears onto children so that, they feel that, if they were humiliated or if they don't feel good enough, they kind of want to protect, they think they want to protect their child from risking, the exposure to that kind of experience. And it ends up very often having the opposite effect because kids are traumatized by that, by those messages.
Doctor, let me ask you this. Is it something that's a little more deep-rooted from, does it get into that self-esteem issue that causes that to happen? I mean, I know a lot of times people have that fear because they don't feel capable of doing it, or they don't feel like they're worthy, or they really add up to what everybody would think of them. So does self-esteem have something to do with that fear?
Well, self-esteem and also, self-concept, how you present, how you think other people are responding to you, as well as how you whether or not you feel that you're good enough or you're smart enough. You know, we have, remember the old Saturday Night Live, Deep Thoughts, you know, they had a segment and this guy would be looking at a mirror and saying, you know, you're smart enough, you're good enough, and God darn it, gosh darn it, people like you. And it was, you know, kind of a trivialization of those kinds of affirmations. But in fact, if you don't think you're good enough or smart enough, or you don't think that you're worthy of going out and giving your message, and very often people who have to present in public and the clients who I deal with in coaching are highly functioning, highly successful people, like attorneys who have a terror of presenting in court because they prefer to do the legal research and they prefer to write the briefs and they prefer to settle out of court. And every once in a while they have to go into court, and they have phobias around that. Or sometimes even a Broadway entertainer may have opening night jitters, or may develop, may have some old fears come up before an audition. Or people, I recently had someone who was in investment banking who was terrified of making a toast at his own wedding, and he knew that, you know, that was nothing to be afraid of. But again, some of it is conditioning, some of it is how we feel about ourselves, and some of it is, very often connected to some event or something that happened in the past where we were given a message by a parent, a teacher, a loved one, other kids, that who do you think you are? You know, who do you think you are standing up, you know, in public and, you know, reciting that poem? And that shame is recalled in a very visceral way, and we tend to avoid those unpleasant experiences.
Now, Dr. Lori, a great question just came up in the chat room, and actually, I kind of struggle with this myself. The question is, how do people change the fear of hearing their own voice? A lot of people, oftentimes we, you know, I work with Tony quite a bit because I just really gave a lot of shout-outs to him a little bit ago, and I'm going to do it again because I think Tony's voice is absolutely amazing. And
yes, you have a great voice, Tony. Very.
Thank you.
Affirmative and yet very warm.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah, very nice radio voice. But there are many times when I struggle with my own voice, and, you know, and I'm just going to be vulnerable and open up and put it out there that, you know, I have some challenges with that. And how do I overcome for lack of a better word, dislike of my own voice? What can I do to change it?
Well, one of the things that we can do on our own, of course, is to record, just record your own voice reading something or giving a talk or, keep a tape recorder next time you're giving a talk or listen to, you know, your radio shows, which I have to do as well because I have a show on webtalkradio.net called The Sixth Sense, and I interview people about how they use their sixth sense in different areas of life, and I have to listen to my own voice, and sometimes I think, God, you know, I sound really, my voice is too low, it's too soft, it sounds creepy, we tend to be very judgmental of ourselves. I think the first step is to get familiar with your own voice and practice listening to yourself with the kind of kindness and compassion that you would listen to someone else, and, you know, really, be patient with yourself as you listen to yourself, and not, you know, try to set your judgments aside, or just give yourself an exercise of just listening without criticizing for 10 minutes. And if you want to choose the voice of someone you'd like to model, you can either work with a voice coach, or you can work with life coach who can help you to isolate certain qualities of the kind of voice you'd like to have, and you can create kind of blueprint, almost like it's a neurological blueprint that you can create.
Well, and I'm going to agree with what the doctor was saying, because I know what happened with me when I was growing up and I was deciding that I wanted to do this for a living, I made a determination that there was a voice that I really admired that was on the radio, and his voice was very similar to my voice, so I mimicked the things that he said, the tones and all the things that he did, that he performed. And as I did that, I was able to, as the doctor said, set a blueprint and put it in place. So it started to affect the way I started speaking. So I pulled more away from trying to sound like him and started sounding more like myself because I started utilizing the tones that I had available to myself. So I will attest that absolutely works. It definitely works.
And I think that a lot of professional broadcasters actually use that as a way of capturing and accessing on a consistent basis whatever those qualities of voice are that you want to emulate and also claim as your own. Because everyone's voice is different, but there are certain qualities, there's certain pacing, inflection, you know, there's volume, there's rhythm, there's the timbre of the voice. And research shows that, in fact, 38% of any communication is in our tone of voice. So we have 55% of our total communication messages through our body language, facial expression, you know, physiology, posture, how we smile, if we don't smile. And 38% is in the tone of voice, and only 7% is the actual words, the verbal content. And that was proven in 1983, a very famous landmark study on, so it's called the silent language, about how we communicate.
Is that where the term, it's not what you say, it's how you say it that matters? Is that kind of what that feel is?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if I were to say to you, and you can't see me, but if I was to say to you, no, I'm not angry at you, would you believe me?
And
you wouldn't. But I just told you I'm not angry at you. You know, the tone of voice weighs in, you know, with us in terms of the emotional content. The total communications package, you know, is 97%, 93% nonverbal. And only 7% is language. And so with radio, you know, you have such a rich window of opportunity to communicate so much with your voice or with our voices. And when you're speaking in public and you're facing an audience, of course, you have the additional resource of a posture, how you use your hands, gestures, how you make eye contact or don't make eye contact, how you use silence and pauses to make, you know, certain impact or to use comedy, to use certain types of timing. And all of that can be modeled if you have specific performers or entertainers or leaders whose style of presentation you would like to have, you know, some version of that for yourself. It's possible to create a blueprint and then wire that in using a kind of a strategy that's based on the silent language research that teaches.
Now Dr. Lori, does that also go for accents? Because I had a couple of people in the chat room that mentioned they felt like their accent was something that they wanted to try to improve or change, or it does that also go for that as well? Because I have a very deep Southern accent, and I try very hard to record my voice and listen to my voice and, you know, try to get rid of it pretty much. So
can that also be changed?
Is there a possibility that can even be changed?
Well, of course it can be changed, but I think, Kathy, you have one of the most beautiful Southern accents I've ever heard, and I truly mean that. And I've know that when we're doing broadcasting, we're doing public speaking, you know, we tend to want to have a voice that, you know, doesn't suggest any particular region. But I personally, you know, I think your accent is natural and rhythmic and very appealing, and it just gives me a sense of who you are as a person. And of course, as a broadcaster, if you want to modify that or you want to change that in some way, yes, you know, you can do that. You can do that through modeling, as I was explaining, by creating a kind of blueprint. And then working with somebody who can walk you through the process of how to activate that blueprint for yourself every time you want to change or shift into that different accent. It's very easy to do, and it's not a very complicated process if you work with someone who really knows what to do. It's just probably one or two sessions. And
okay,
that
now,
is a lot of what I do with people on the phone with performers and people who need help with public speaking and also in person.
Now I want to move a little bit more into the actual the methods and the presentation itself. I know the voice inflection and how you use your voice, those things are very important. But what about the actual presentation, the intro? How should you start a presentation? I know there are so many different styles and there are so many different ways, and I've heard many different types of presenters. I have heard presenters that will do an hour-long presentation and pretty much read from their notes the entire time. And for whatever reason, it seems to be effective for them because they get a lot of work. And I don't necessarily prefer that style, but it works for them. So in your opinion, what do you feel is the best presentation style, whether it's their intro or how they conduct themselves when they're moving around, their movements? Or is there any model that you would even recommend? Or could you just say that, you know, whatever works for that person?
Well, I think it also depends on what kind of venues and what type of audiences. You know, if you go to a medical conference or, I guess, you know, where somebody's presenting certain types of business information, they can read from their notes and they can use a PowerPoint, which doesn't necessarily even have graphics on it. And that's going to be sufficient. If you're a motivational speaker, of course, you really need to engage with each member of the audience so that person is connecting with you and your experience. And you want to make a connection that says, you know, I'm here because I've had certain experiences and I sense or I know that some or many of you are having the same life experiences, and so, you know, I'd like to share with you what I've learned by going through, you know, these particular tough, you know, challenges in my life. And that, just, you know, speaking very simply from your heart, if you're a motivational speaker, is probably, you know, the model of excellence. If you think about someone who has inspired you as a motivational speaker, and you think about what did they do to connect with and draw out the audience, probably the most compelling piece of this was that person's sincerity. And I don't think that there are any formulas for sincerity. I mean, you have to, and that's why you do have to make yourself vulnerable and yet have tremendous courage at the same time, because you really want to expose and open up that part of yourself that says, listen, I think I have something to share with you that's going to help you get through this recession.
One thing I also wanted to ask about, you know, the actual presentation and how your presence when you're in front of a crowd, how do you, I seem to struggle with what to do with my hands. If I'm using PowerPoint, then I'm fine. But if I'm not using PowerPoint, I tend to kind of struggle with the pacing and not knowing what to do with my hands. How can I get over that? Because that in itself makes me anxious and tense, and that just adds to the anxiety.
Well, somebody who was really a genius, and I'm sure that he must have been coached by someone who was very skillful at using hand movements, can mark off certain phrases that can be used to emphasize certain words or certain turns of phrase. And there are certain ways of showing your hands, literally like showing your hand. It's like saying, here I am, I'm being open with you. If you keep your hands more or less horizontal and flex your hands from the wrist, rather than moving your hands vertically, which is kind of like a scolding gesture, you know, or some people will, like preachers, they'll mark off certain words and they'll use that finger like the finger of God coming down, you know, and they'll kind of point and, you know, move the finger up and down. That gives a kind of judgmental, you know, you feel like you're a child in school. But the research has found that if you keep your hands kind of loose and almost with your palms open like you're holding a tray, and you just kind of move your hands in rhythm to what you're talking about, when you want to say something important, you literally open your hand like you're showing people what's on the tray in the palm of your hand, and that's a signal to your audience that, you know, this is, I'm really showing you something that's really important here. And there's a very interesting case of, I think it's a young woman, or young female student in high school who apparently she had some kind of reading problem, dyslexia, some kind of learning challenge, and they had there was a history course, and it was a very, very, very tough course, and everybody else in the class failed the final test, and she got an A, and nobody could figure out how she did it. And she said, well, it's very simple. I've been watching the teacher, and when the teacher uses his hands like this, and she made a certain gesture, it's always when he's saying something that's very, you know, this is his way of showing me, this is something very important, it's going to be on the test, so I would write that down. So as everybody else was cramming for this test, trying to second guess and figure out what the teacher was doing, here was this dyslexic or learning challenged kid who was smart enough to be able to observe that the teacher's hand gestures were indicative or marking out the important chapters of the important points, the key points that were going to be on the exam. So you can train yourself to do that. And again, you know, think of someone who uses his or her hands in a way that you would like to incorporate, and, you know, you can make that part of your blueprint. And then it's just, then you just feel very comfortable. Once you've done it once, your hands just become a natural part of the flow of how you're presenting.
And yeah. You know, Doctor, I just wanted to say, Kathy, that that's so true, because one of the folks that I've always admired as far as a motivational speaker is Les Brown. And Les is somebody that I consider the king of the gesture. I mean, if he has something to get across, sometimes he doesn't have to say too much of anything, and you get the message just by his hand movements and his body movement. Regardless of how subtle it may be, it really kind of intensifies the impact of what he's saying verbally, because those gestures kind of co-sign all the things that he's saying. And one thing I wanted to ask, Doctor, when a person uses those hand gestures, depending, of course, like you said, the vertical versus the horizontal, when you talk about the horizontal, isn't it give a feel of being more welcoming to the audience?
Oh, absolutely. It's a safer gesture. It gives a sense of acceptance. It literally, like one of my teachers said, it's like you're serving the audience, literally, love. It's like you've got a tray of appetizers that you hold your hands horizontally, and it's like making an offering. And so it conveys in your body language, you know, I'm making an offering. I'm serving you. I'm not here to scold you. I'm not here to, you know, apprehend you or to force something down your throat. I'm actually offering you or serving you with information or ideas that I hope will be helpful for you. So there's a certain, you know, element, the keeping your hands horizontal, it also conveys a certain, and I think an appropriate deference and respect and humility before the audience that I think gains rapport probably more quickly than anything you can say in an intro. You're asking about intros. Intros can be, you know, they can be, I've used jokes, I've used, you know, all kinds of different, you know, tricks, I guess, and probably, you know, again, the easiest thing if you're a motivational speaker is to just explain how you came to be standing in front of these people at this room at this particular time. Because that's, you know, I believe, you know, that that's not an accident. There's a reason why you're there and nobody else is there, and that these people came because you have something to offer them. that's very special. And it starts with you.
That's true. That's true. Now, I know there's a lot of speculation about different do's and don'ts, and you should or you shouldn't. Other than the typical things we all know, never cross your arms because that's, you know, kind of shutting the audience out. Don't speak in monotone type of style of voice. What are some of the other absolute don'ts that we should be made aware of when we're presenting in front of a group?
Well, again, that depends on your venue. You know, a lot of scientists and business people who are doing, you know, very, you know, informational or statistical matter-of-fact presentations that don't really have to make eye contact with the audience. I would say probably the biggest don't is to avoid eye contact with the audience, but that's my personal style. So even if I'm, you know, presenting at a behavioral health conference and I'm presenting to professionals, I like to make eye contact, but that's my preference. So, you know, I don't think that there are any hard and fast do's or don'ts. For me, the biggest no-no would be, you know, the failure to make eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the failure to really express appreciation for your audience, you know, that these people are here willingly or unwillingly. When I used to give corporate seminars, we used to say that there were three types of people who came to these seminars, and they were either self-directed learners, meaning that, you know, they came because they chose the topic because it was something they needed to learn to improve their job performance, or they were vacationers and their boss was giving them a 3-day all-expense-paid trip to San Francisco or New York or Orlando, and they were going to start to go shopping or go to Disney World after lunch on the second day, and, you know, they weren't really interested. They were just kind of killing time till they could go out and play. And then the third group were called prisoners, and prisoners were sent to the class because it was felt that they needed, you know, they needed correction in some way. They needed to be fixed, and they were ordered to go to the class. And I had people show up, but they didn't even know what the class was or why they were there, but it showed up in their planners, their electronic planners for that day. You know, you will go to such and such a place for this, you know, 2-day training. And, you know, when I asked people why they were there, and I would find out with horror that nobody knew why they were there. They had just been told that they had to be there. And, of course, everyone was frustrated and resentful because they didn't know, you know, who I was or why management insisted that they be there. I would just acknowledge the prisoners, and I would say, well, you know, if you're prisoners here, all I can do is try to make your stay in jail as comfortable as possible and as painless as possible. Because I'm sorry that you're a prisoner. I mean, I would probably feel, you know, as frustrated as you are, and that would really break the ice. So finding out, if you can, a little bit about your group, depending on the size of the group, and acknowledging them.
Yeah.
I think if you fail to acknowledge your audience at the beginning, you're setting up a barrier that if you do make a mistake or if you are having an off day, that barrier can become like the big chill in the room. And if you acknowledge your audience at the beginning, even if, as I do sometimes, all my worst fears have come true. I've got stage fright in front of people. I've stammered. I've stuttered. I've tripped over things. I've broken the, you know, projector when we used to do, like, overhead projectors. I mean, all of the things that could go wrong in front of a group have actually happened. But because I had created the rapport by acknowledging the audience, I never felt like I was going to be crippled by that. I would just keep going. And I think that, you know, it makes it much easier for you as a speaker, anyone as a speaker, to just keep going if you just appreciate your audience right from the get-go. They'll be more likely to be compassionate and less likely to, you know, be rejecting or critical or sarcastic.
Now, Doctor, I want to ask you this. When you're preparing for a presentation and you're rehearsing and you're practicing and you're going through it over and over and over again and you're getting yourself ready, is there a time that you should say to yourself, you know, I can't do this anymore, I can't prepare anymore? Is there a such thing as over-preparation? Because I know for me, from a performance standpoint, I've done choirs, I've been in plays, all kinds of things. There's a point for me where I have to say, look, if I do this again, I know I'm going to mess up. So I just need to stop myself and just, I know it, I'm going to do it. The next time I want to do it, I want to do it for the audience. Is there a time that you have to say that, or is there no such thing as over-preparation?
Oh, I think, you know, I tend to be one of those people that prepare up to a point. And as soon as I start to feel, you know, tired, mentally tired, I'll give myself a break and just reflect a little bit. And I tend to kind of like to let my, you know, my inner guidance, if you will, let me know when enough is enough, and when I feel comfortable, and I know that, and that's different than, of course, preparing for a play where you have to know your lines, and that's very different than kind of talk where you have notes and you have, you know, you have some aids up there. You've got your PowerPoint, you've got a flip chart, or, you know, you've got something you can refer to. But so it's slightly different. But when you feel calm inside, you know, when you feel that, okay, I feel comfortable with this, I think that's the time to let it go. Because your unconscious mind, your subconscious mind is going to continue to be working on absorbing and integrating and aligning whatever it is that, you know, you need to complete the process to be ready. And it's not like you go to sleep and your unconscious mind isn't, you know, still kind of working on improving your performance as you sleep. Your mind is always at work and trying to help you.
And I just want to add to that, because, Tony, I know you've been doing public speaking a lot longer than I have, but I have come to realize that, especially when it's a topic that I'm very passionate about and I'm very familiar with, sometimes the more I practice, the less effective I feel. Every time I practice, I feel like I'm, you know, less effective. And I feel like I do better in front of an audience when I just speak from my heart. You know, when I just speak on the topic from a place of passion and from a spiritual place, it just seems to come across better, even when I don't rehearse.
Well, isn't that, you know, that's the kind of speaking that you're probably best at.
Right.
And I think, again, depends on the venue and depends on what feels most natural for you and what's going to help you to connect with your audience. And I think that's very important. Think about who your audience is. I was preparing for my first corporate seminar, and I noticed I had a list of the people attending, and I noticed that they were all CEOs and presidents. And instead of focusing on the material, which I knew very well, and I was excited to be presenting in front of this group, I focused on everybody's title. And I really got myself into a panic. And I went, oh, my God, I don't have the right suit. And I drove around the mall in a frenzy. And you know, I wasted all this time, you know, in anxiety when I could have just been, you know, reviewing the material and the anecdotes. And of course, when everybody showed up, they were so nice. And they were people. And they were there because the information about, you know, how to use their intuition and their gut in decision making and proving the performance of their business, it was something that they were really interested in. And I realized that I had let myself really drift away from what was important, which was, you know, how am I going to connect with this class here, and, you know, what do I have to offer that's helpful. And instead, I was just completely intimidated by, you know, these titles after people's names. And it was something that I only did once. I never made that mistake again.
One of the things I wanted to try to get in, because I, believe it or not, our time is winding down. We're coming up on our final 4 minutes. But I wanted to just ask your opinion about introductions and how important introductions are, because I know we typically tend to write our own introductions for whoever may be introducing us, and what I know it probably does depend on the venue and your audience, but what is there like a general rule? Do people typically want to know about your credentials, your experience, names of clients you've worked with, your education level? What are some of the things that you would recommend that you include in your introduction?
Well, I think, you know, a basic bio and what makes you, what gives you the expertise to address this particular group. You know, if you're doing motivational speaking, say about single parenting, and I'm a single parent, so I'm very interested that you're having a show on being a single parent, then, you know, you want to emphasize that you're a single parent in your bio. And by the way, for anyone who's listening, I think single parenting is the most challenging job in the world, because we weren't really designed to be mothers and fathers, or fathers and mothers.
Right.
So
we too.
It's my heart goes out to everybody who, you know, is raising kids by themselves. It is very demanding work and very rewarding, but it's a lot harder than it looks in the movies.
Now, Tony, you had a question?
Well, I was just going to say, and I know we are coming up on the time, I just wanted to ask, Doctor, those first things that people can do, if you can do just a quick synopsis to evaluate, you know, kind of take a look at what they're thinking to challenge themselves to get past that fear, maybe some quick tools.
Well, I would say, you know, think about a wall and write your fears on the wall, just as if you're writing graffiti on the wall. Just write down each one and then mentally project yourself so that you're sitting on top of the wall. So the fears are going to be on the wall that you're sitting on. And look out over that wall, because on the other side of that wall, you don't have any fear. The fears aren't there. Write them down and, you know, make them different colors and just, you know, imagine that you're going to sit on the top of that wall of your fears. And whatever it is that you're seeing from the top of that wall, I guarantee you it's not your fear. And that will open up a whole field of possibilities. Because when we are seeing, when we are in fear, we don't see. It's like there's a wall in front of us, and it's literally like a wall of our fear. We don't see over that wall. And if anyone would like, you know, to work one-on-one, you can reach me at 1-877-DR-LORI, and that's probably the best way to get in touch with me at the moment.
Yes, I wanted you to make sure you give your website information as well as any other information. I know you have a book, and could you give us the name of the book?
The book is Sixth Sense, Unlocking Your Ultimate Mind Power. It's available on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble stores and all the online outlets. And my website is unlockyoursixthsense.com and also Lori Nadel, LauriNadel.com. And they have links to each other. And they have a contact link, so you can email me.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Nadel, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And, Tony, I hope you feel better. And thank you all in the chat room and that are listening in the archive downloads. And also thank you to the people that dialed in, well, the ones who will be listening in the archive downloads. Thank you all for being with us and hanging in with us with our technical difficulties. We really appreciate you joining us. And we will see you this time, same time next week. And we're going to sign off for now. I'm Kathy Holloway Hill.
And I'm Tony Lamont.
And we will see you same time next week. Thank you, Dr. Nadel.
Thank you so much. Have a great week.
You do the same. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you.